we sat there the whole day just with blank minds. How did that happen?
And sometimes evil creeps right in.
There is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be found.
Nobody thinks that, you know, that stranger you meet on the street someday turns out to be a murderer.
On November 10th, 2005, Gainesville police are called out to a small student bungalow. Once inside the Florida house, they make a terrible discovery. A woman's lifeless body is found face down on her bed. The TV and the lights are on, and there are no signs of foul play. It's the last act of a tragic story that started 2 years earlier. In 2003, 22-year-old anthropology student Michelle Herndon and third-year student Jessica Siebel-Zacher become fast friends while working part-time as personal trainers at a local gym.
So, what are you doing tonight?
I don't know. I might just go home. I have one of my migraines is coming on again. It's really, really annoying.
Well, that sucks.
Yeah.
I was thinking I was going to have, like, a dinner party thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I might come by for a little.
I don't know what exactly it was, but we just hit it off immediately. We had the same personality traits where, you know, we were just a little bit country, you know, but still could be girly, and we just had a lot of the same things in common. We just wanted to have fun. We didn't care what other people thought about us. We'd just be the two girls that were in the back of the bar laughing and, you know, rolling around laughing so hard. We were kind of our yin and yang to each other. She was so much more thoughtful and considerate, and it made me soften up. We both drove trucks. You know, we would share stories of our families that had the same kind of, I don't want to say redneck on TV, but the same kind of country tendencies, you know, getting our trucks stuck in the mud.
22-year-old Michelle, who hails from the small town of Live Oak, Florida, is less than a year away from graduating and doesn't have much money. She lives in a small house off campus, one of several low-cost student houses on the same block. Friends playfully tease her about her rundown student bungalow.
It's bare minimum. You have a mattress, a desk, maybe a kitchen table if you're lucky. She was complaining about a noise coming from the attic, and I'm sure it was, you know, some sort of rodent or something, but I was like, yeah, I bet there's a homeless guy living in your attic, because she lived right near one of the not-so-great parts of town. But she was like any other college student. You'd have barely a penny left over.
Broke or not, Michelle always aims to do the right thing. She's passionate about recycling.
Hey.
Hi.
Jess.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good.
What are you doing?
Drinking with you.
She started a program at the gym and had recycling bins, you know, in different areas in the gym, and would actually bring it home back to her house and put it in her own personal recycling bin.
Put that down.
Even a stranger on the side of the road, if she saw them put a plastic bottle in the trash can, if there's a recycling bin right there, she would go, excuse me, don't you see that there's a recycling bin right there? I mean,
she seemed like a typical student in the sense that she was not sure what was coming next. She was searching for a pathway, and she was unsure of the one she was on. Just stressed about life, you know? What am I doing? Is this the right thing? Or what am I gonna do? All those kind of things. That was always sort of right at the forefront with her. Seemed like she was unsure.
Oh, you know.
The uncertainty and stress sometimes get to Michelle.
I remember she had migraines and told me that.
We knew that she had headaches every now and again.
Michelle was the all-American girl. She was a personal trainer, teaching fitness to people while she was going through college. She was very idealistic and wanted to change the world.
Anybody that she saw that needed a helping hand, she was right there wanting to do the most that she could.
She was going to join the Peace Corps.
Every once in a while, you just caught a little glimpse of something. You know, you contacted something in her and she laughed. just in a really natural, present way, and that was really sweet.
Michelle spends a lot of time at Jessica's house on campus, along with Jessica's huge circle of friends. In contrast to Michelle's small student digs, Jessica's house is a hive of activity.
It was the perfect college house. The kitchen, we had a table in that kitchen that probably sat 12 people, and that was the center of everything. We had a big backyard with a big fire pit. We could have, you know, big parties and gatherings and have people around the fire.
You always have the best roommates.
Yeah, like this one over here.
With the new school year fast approaching, Jessica is on the hunt for new roommates. She places an ad in the local newspaper.
Yeah.
So now that you guys are leaving, I mean, did you find someone new to live here?
There have been a couple applicants, but I'm narrowing in on one.
Really?
Yeah.
What's his name?
Oliver.
Oliver?
Yeah.
Oliver O'Quinn, a 27-year-old nurse, answers the ad. He's new in town, having just recently moved from Jessup, Georgia.
I just want to make sure it's not some random, like, 50-year-old single male or something that won't fit in. You know, you want to make sure it's an actual college student or somebody young and trying to do the same things that you're trying to do. First thoughts were, I could live with that guy. He wore glasses, mild-mannered, quiet. He's a nurse, so he has a job. He can pay the bills. He's just a nice, normal, low-key person I could get along with.
Nice to meet you, too.
Jessica invites Oliver to move in.
He really honestly was never even home that much. He worked 12-hour shifts at the hospital, and he seemed to work a lot of them. Kind of kept to himself, or he'd, you know, be out in the living room watching TV.
Thanks for this wonderful meal.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for coming, guys.
Michelle soon becomes friends with the latest addition to Jessica's household.
I mean, he worked a ton, so we tried to include him to make him feel like he had some sort of a sense of belonging. So he would always join us if he wasn't doing anything.
They talk about everything, but especially Michelle's somewhat complicated love life.
You know, find a place to live and see where that goes.
Where would you like to live?
Jason.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That'd be great. Mm-hmm.
Jason is Michelle's old on-again, off-again boyfriend who lives and works in Miami.
I think with the long distance, they didn't want to hold each other back, but they wanted to still enjoy each other. From day one when I met her, there was always Jason. Jason was there long before I was. I know she always talked so fondly of him. Her family loved him. She talked about him a lot, but it was never a, I don't know, it was never like a 100% sure of herself. It was always, you know, I like him, I know that I like him, but I don't know if this is gonna work out.
But with Jason 340 miles away in Miami, Michelle has been seeing a guy named Scott.
He was a guitarist in one of the band that we saw all the time.
You know, I got into nursing because I wanted to help people after the war.
Oh, you went to war?
Yeah, you didn't mention you went to war.
As Michelle opens up to Oliver about her complex social life, he in turn begins to talk about a harrowing past in the Army.
Really?
How long ago was that?
He told me that he was a captain in the Air Force and that he had done some work in Africa, that he had jumped into Afghanistan right after 9/11. And, you know, all sorts of, gone to, like, Superman school is what he called it.
Well, let's cheers to that.
Thanks for coming, guys.
Yeah.
This is delicious.
Oliver also shares personal stories from his hometown.
Here.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
He talked a lot about how, you know, oh, he met a girl on this day, or, oh, his friends were going to throw him a birthday party.
But soon, both girls will discover that Oliver doesn't seem to have any real friends. In fact, he's been keeping a lot of secrets.
You could almost hear the violin music build up as time went on. It became a little scarier and then a little scarier.
It's the start of a new school year, and student Michelle Herndon is seeing a lot of her friend's new roommate, Oliver.
Hey.
What are you doing here? I was just going to do some errands.
Even though they're both busy, Oliver seems to pop up more and more.
Oliver said how much he enjoyed interacting with Michelle, that she's very easy to talk to. I would see Michelle later and say, hey, Michelle, how was your day? What'd you do today? Oh, Oliver and I had coffee together. She went to the dog park all the time with her dog, so I'm sure it was just a quick, hey, if you're not doing anything, that's where I'll be. And he always showed up. If we were hanging out and he was sitting on the couch, we'd be like, hey, you know, why don't you come with us? I know that if she saw Oliver seeming down or seeming lonely, that she wouldn't even hesitate to, hey, you know, let's go have some coffee. Let's go do something. Let's cheer you up.
The more he learned about her, the more he wanted to be around her.
He always talks about his friends, but I mean, I've never met any of them. It's just weird.
As days turn into weeks, Michelle and Jessica notice that nothing about Oliver rings true.
I mean, neither Michelle or myself had ever met any of his friends or any of his girlfriends, and it seemed like he never really had anything going on. I mean, nobody ever came over to the house.
And, you know, his war story, like, what was that? That's obviously not true. He's way too
and
young.
And my boyfriend asked him, you know, how old are you? And you're a captain in the Air Force? And he didn't say anything in front of Oliver at the time, but later kind of said, hey, Jessica, Oliver's not old enough to be a captain in the Air Force. There's just no way that that's possible. And, you know, I told my boyfriend, that's fine. If that's what Oliver needs to say to think that I think more of him, that's fine. I don't need to correct him. I don't need to put him down any. If he needs those stories to make himself feel better, then he can have those stories.
Michelle decides to move into a better house. She asks her landlord if she can rent one of his newly renovated units nearby.
Oh, hey, Peter.
Hey, Michelle.
How are you?
Good, good. How are you?
Come in. rent.
Yes. Right. That's right. That time of the month again.
Here you go.
Thanks.
Sorry it's late.
That's okay.
Hey, I saw that you're renovating apartments across the street.
Yeah.
Every time she got a little bit more income, she wanted to upgrade to the next best house on the property.
I was working on another house, and she saw that place, and she said, could I move in there? And so we worked things out and said, sure. She was really super enthusiastic about moving in there.
That's good.
Yeah.
All right.
So I think it probably at that point, some things had started to come together for her.
Great. Okay,
thanks. You know, she was going through a positive transformation. She was evolving very fast and finding her way, and her self-confidence and her radiance was growing.
Perhaps because she started spending more time with her boyfriend, Jason.
That was all she ever talked about was, oh, Jason's come to town, I get to go hang out with Jason. For her, it was hard because she really had such strong feelings for him, but it being long distance, they wanted to both kind of see if maybe it was really meant to be, or should we really, you know, buckle down and make this work. They were gonna really commit to each other and, you know, not let anything else get in the way, but really commit to each other and 100% be in a relationship.
So seriously, but what is going on with Oliver?
What?
You guys hang out, like, all the time.
I don't know.
You totally have the hots for him.
No.
First, I thought he had a crush on you, but...
No, I don't.
You're the culprit.
Come on. I only hang out with him because he really looks like he needs a friend. I would never date a guy like that.
Like I said, okay.
It was playful teasing. You know Oliver has a crush on you, right? And I think she was flattered by it. I mean, she didn't think he was anything she couldn't handle.
Thanks. Cheers.
We had a party at my house, a big bonfire in the backyard like we normally do.
Oh,
and, you know, a bunch of chairs set up in a circle around the bonfire. And it was mostly friends from the gym. And of course, Oliver lives at the house, so he was invited as well. Whenever Michelle would get up and go talk to somebody else, Oliver would be right behind her. He would get up and move right next to her.
So, have you noticed that Oliver's been following you, like, everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just seem like a lost puppy. Like this little lonely dork.
I don't know.
Hey.
Oh, hey.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I didn't know you had a dog.
Oh.
Hi.
Yeah, it's my friend's dog.
You're just walking in front of them, or?
Yeah. They live down the street. I'm just doing them a favor.
Nice. Well, I'm going to continue.
A few days later, Michelle has a strange run-in with Oliver.
He showed up with somebody's dog. It wasn't my dog. It wasn't any dog that Michelle recognized. He didn't have a dog. We have no idea where this dog came from. But he showed up with a dog just to, you know, sit and enjoy the dog park with her.
It's great seeing you.
Yeah, you too.
Nobody knows whose dog it was.
Hey, Jess, yeah. Something weird just happened. Yeah, Oliver has a dog and was walking.
I didn't know Oliver had a dog.
Maybe it's just innocent, but it's just kind of weird. Yeah.
The romantic weekend finally arrives, and Jason drives from Miami to Gainesville to be with Michelle.
There was a Halloween weekend where Michelle and Jason were going to talk about their relationship, and it was kind of a pivotal moment in taking things more serious.
It was always something that she talked about. Oh, Jason's coming into town. I can't hang out with you this weekend. Very giddy and just very excited. There's no better way to describe it, but just like a giddy, excited schoolgirl.
Hey.
Hey.
How you doing?
Thank you.
Oh, you're so
But he's not the only one who visits that night.
Somehow, Oliver seemed to know that they were going to meet and arrived out of the house and wouldn't leave.
Hey, Oliver! What are you doing here? Oliver! What are you doing? Are you okay? What's going on? Hey, what's going on?
Can I help you?
Oliver?
What's wrong with this guy?
I began to suspect that he was watching the house because how did he always seem to know when Jason was coming over to the house? They found that disturbing.
Hello? Hey. Yeah, no, some glass just broke in my kitchen and I wasn't even there.
Despite the bizarre drop-in from Oliver, Jason's visit goes better than expected. Yeah. Michelle can barely contain herself.
Dinner.
They had had the best conversation and had decided, you know, really, let's quit playing games with this. Let's just 100% be in a relationship, 100% dedicate to each other, and see what happens. So I know she was very excited.
But just 6 days later, Michelle's landlord stumbles onto a scene that would contradict this. Peter Alcorn stops by after trying unsuccessfully to get Michelle on the phone.
I said, I need to get these tools, I need to come by. And I didn't get a call back, so I knocked on the door, and this guy opened the door, leaned his head out, didn't have a shirt on, and said, now's not a really good time. How about in a few hours? But I didn't know if he had just gotten out of the shower and, you know, was just covering himself, or if he didn't want me to look inside, or what, I don't know. And this seemed a little bit odd that I couldn't reach her, and that then this guy was saying, you know, later.
Who are you?
I'm Peter. I'm the landlord.
Oh, okay. Well, you could come back later, maybe.
I'll call it.
I always remember him with glasses, and it sort of seemed like he had whatever, his little curly hair, and kind of a slight guy, and a little squirrely, you know, a little squirrely.
Hello? There you are.
But her landlord is worried for nothing. Michelle calls him back a short time later.
Okay.
I did finally talk to her after that, and she said, oh, sorry about that. I've been having these really bad migraines, and this friend was in town, and he had some migraine medicine, and so I was kind of out of it. Something like that. It's not my position to meddle, and so I didn't really pursue it.
But later, when Michelle misses yet another phone call, people start to panic.
The interior lights were on. The television was on.
And obviously something was going on.
Student Michelle Herndon and her boyfriend Jason decide to take the next step in their relationship and are planning their future together.
She was just going on and on about the conversation she had had with Jason the day before, about how they were gonna, you know, fully commit to each other, you know, 100% in the relationship.
That was an awesome movie.
That was great. I love that.
She was happier than I have seen her in a very long time.
Tell you.
Okay, what is it?
Me and Jason are moving in together.
Oh my God, congratulations, that's amazing.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
So, like, what about Oliver?
What about Oliver? Like, there was nothing that was ever gonna happen with him. I mean, he's not even good looking and he's kind of nerdy.
Okay.
That Tuesday night, we were supposed to have dinner together, but she said she had a big project or something she had to study for, so we were scheduled for the next Wednesday night.
10 days after Jason's visit, Jessica can't get a hold of Michelle.
Wednesday night, we were supposed to have dinner together, and I couldn't get a hold of her. But I honestly didn't think much of it, because I knew she had been kind of dating that guy that was in the band, and I knew that she was gonna commit to Jason. So I honestly thought that maybe she was, you know, meeting with the guy from the band and telling him we can't see each other anymore. You know, I honestly thought that was probably what was happening. So I gave her, I don't know, maybe half a dozen phone calls, but I really didn't think much of it.
Yeah, hey, it's me again. Look, if there's something wrong, you just tell me. You don't have to not answer the phone. Like, this is crazy.
Jason also calls Michelle repeatedly. He hasn't spoken to her in 2 days, and that's not like her at all.
Well, I'm starting to get worried. You just let me know you're okay? Anything?
He drove up from Miami and was there at like 2 or 3 in the morning, banging on the doors.
In a panic, Jason makes the 5-hour drive to Michelle's house.
Michelle! Michelle! Michelle!
He said he could call Michelle's phone and he could hear it ringing in the house. And her dog, Duke, of course, would bark every time he banged on the door. He just called 911 and sat there and waited.
When the police finally managed to pry the door open, they make a horrific discovery. Michelle Herndon's lifeless body.
When we did go in, we found that the windows were locked, all the doors were locked, the lights were on, the television was on, the dog was bouncing around the living room. Everything seemed to be in order.
Early 20s, white female, possibly deceased, need paramedics.
the officers go over to the Michelle and see that she is dead and has been dead for some time. There was nothing that really jumped out at us when we made our initial entry, other than, of course, her being dead.
There was no sign of a break-in. There was no, violence anywhere. It seemed like she had just died naturally, which doesn't make any sense because she's a young, healthy person. I think it was just the complete shock and how.
There is absolutely nothing indicating foul play. There's nothing indicating why Michelle Hernan is dead.
It's creepy. That we get the usual, smoking gun, drug dealer, or mom and dad fighting, but something like this, it's unusual.
The phone starts ringing at like 6 o'clock in the morning, which is way too early. And I think the first time I didn't answer it, I didn't even look to see who was calling.
My phone had died. My cell phone had died. And when I turned it on, it was filled with messages. I was very upset that my phone had been off and I had not been able to be reached.
The next time it rang, somebody left a message, and I think it was somebody from the gym saying that, Michelle hadn't shown up for work. If I knew where she was, please give them the call.
I don't know if there's a fire or if somebody's hurt or something's happening.
And then another phone call came in, and it was Michelle's mom. And I could hear on the answering machine, hey, it's Belinda. I can't get a hold of Michelle. I know you don't live too far away from her, so if you could just go over there and check on her and let me know.
I think her mom called me, and she was completely freaked out, and she was on her way driving. And then I think I said, you need to probably get off the phone. I'm going over there right now. We'll see what's going on.
So I don't even think I called Belinda back right away. I got up, threw on some clothes, and got in the car. She lived maybe a mile away from me. And I think I called Belinda in the car and said, hey, I'm on my way over there right now. I'll let you know as soon as I get there.
Excuse me.
Yeah, this is
what's
a car
going
scene,
on?
Man. You can't come here.
Yeah, but I know her. What's happening?
The first person I walked into was Detective Douglas. And I've never approached a crime scene before. I didn't know what to do. I just sort of walked up and waited for somebody to notice me. And he walked right up to me and said, did you know the person living in this house? And I said, yeah, it's my friend Michelle. And he said that she was found, I think he said deceased or passed or expired. I don't know what term, but whatever it was, I didn't hear it. And I just kind of was blinded. It's blindsided. I don't even think I realized. I don't know. I don't.
Who did this?
I don't even think it really occurred to me when he said it. I heard what he said, but I don't think I really absorbed what he said. Jason and I were sitting there. Michelle's mom called us over and over again on our cell phones, and we just didn't answer. You can't tell somebody that their daughter's dead over the phone. And we didn't know what to say or what to do, so we just sat there. We sat there the whole day just with blank minds. How did that happen? And she showed up eventually. She drove all the way down from Live Oak. And she'll tell you that she was driving, 90 miles an hour the whole time.
Her mother had just arrived. I don't know how she got there, because I know that they were trying to get her. They had police cars out trying to get her off the road. And it was something I will never forget. As a parent, you see that happen, and you identify with it in a visceral and horrible way. That she had just learned that her child was dead. And it was quite intense.
Landlord Peter Alcorn has the unsettling task of fixing the door the police pried open.
I had to replace the door that day, so I went in then. The TV was on. I think it was on and it was loud. And they just left everything the way it was, and I asked if I could turn the TV off. I was not up for the task of replacing the door at that time, but I had to do it because you couldn't close the place up. And the sound of the TV was very disturbing. So they turned the TV off. I really didn't even want to see anything in there. It was a very, very dark day, and I didn't want to see any of it. But I couldn't focus on replacing the door with that noise. It was just a out of place, loud noise, constantly reminding us that something was very wrong.
After several hours, police still cannot find any visible cause of the young fitness instructor's death. There is no blood, no bruising, and no sign of assault of any kind.
When we find a young person who's died before their time, you know, we look at it very carefully.
Something's just not right here.
She didn't exhibit any of the at-risk indicators that a lot of young people may have. And, you know, the empty alcohol bottles or perhaps drug paraphernalia, any kind of drugs, even an entry-level drug like marijuana or anything like that. There was no indication whatsoever that she was involved in this.
It looked like bizarre natural causes, unexplained natural causes.
In the home, we found what appeared to be a used condom, and that would be significant. So we had the crime lab guy collected it, and we would submit that for processing. But that was about the only thing that had any significance, any evidentiary significance in the house.
But later that day, the medical examiner makes a startling discovery.
I got a call from Dr. Burt, the medical examiner, and said, the initial autopsy is complete. The examination of the body is complete, and I found what appears to be a needle stick in her left arm. And that, of course, was very significant.
Which arm? Excellent. Good work, Marcia. Bye.
I've seen sloppy ones on IV drug users and some of the results of that. But this was precise. She could not have self-administered that. It was physically impossible.
With daylight waning, investigators decide to return the next day to continue their search.
The following morning, myself and our crime lab returned to the scene and expanded our search out, which ended up out by the curb near the trash bins that are picked up by the garbage trucks. And laying on the ground next to one of the bins was a small plastic supermarket bag.
And that's what ultimately broke this case open.
Sir, what you got? Syringes, bandages.
So when you look at the photographs of that area, the trash cans are empty, everything's been picked up, and in the back corner lays a small trash bag.
We're very lucky. Had he taken that bag with him, or had it been trash day and it had been inside one of the bins, it would have been lost forever.
When law enforcement opened that trash bag up, they could tell it was from Michelle Hearn's apartment. There were recent receipts in there, but also there were now empty bottles of a drug called propofol, and there were syringes and IV equipment to administer drugs into the human body. Found in that small trash bag with the propofol were vials of two other drugs, midazolam and etomidate, drugs that could provide some relief to someone with migraines.
Right. Okay. Take it back in.
What they found when they tested Michelle Hernan's body for the drug propofol was that was the cause of her death. She had more than four times the lethal dose in her system at the time of her death.
Michelle's mysterious death has now officially become a murder investigation, and it's about to take an unexpected turn.
I'm frothing at the mouth, you know? Let's get this guy.
There was a lot at stake, and it was a nerve-wracking situation for everybody.
November 10th, 2005, University of Florida student Michelle Herndon's body is found in her home. The cause of death is a lethal dose of the sedative propofol. Gainesville police now have a homicide on their hands and little to go on but the DNA found inside a condom at the scene.
I think with any crime, there comes that initial fog. You know, there's a lot happening, there's a lot going on. You're trying to determine what the scene tells you about what happened. You're trying to do an autopsy to determine what you can learn about the cause of death.
With DNA found at the crime scene and a suspicious pinprick in Michelle's arm, police begin to search for answers. Anyone close to Michelle quickly becomes a suspect, and her personal relationships are closely examined.
Not really.
What we have to do is, as any males that she's had contact with, that or close contact with, or potential contact with, we have them submit to cheek swabs.
When was the last time you were at Michelle's place?
Last week, Halloween.
We found a condom there.
Yeah, that's mine.
The DNA on the used condom belongs to Jason, but he's got a solid alibi for the time of the murder. He was hours away in Miami. So investigators turn their attention to the evidence found in the trash. Who did Michelle know who had access to professional-grade drugs?
When they found that trash bag, I believe the focus started to hone in on who in Michelle's life, who did she know that worked in the medical profession? Who in her life would have had access to the drug propofol or access to syringes and whatnot?
Yeah. My roommate, Oliver. Yeah.
He's a nurse. And they said, anybody else? And I was like, no, not that I can think of.
Have you seen him?
Well, he went away to New York a couple days ago, and I haven't heard from him since.
Jessica told me that, you know, this guy was just enamored with Michelle, but you know, as far as Michelle was concerned, you know, he's just kind of a geeky little guy that, you know, she'd just be nice to, but certainly not a romantic interest.
Michelle's former landlord, Peter Elkhorn, also tells Detective Michael Douglas about his unusual encounter with Oliver and about Michelle's migraines.
My only guess is that Oliver had treated her in some fashion for this migraine that she suffered from.
Detective Douglas realizes that he needs to locate Oliver to get more answers.
Well, at this point now, of course, I'm fascinated with Oliver O'Quinn because I've attempted to contact him. I've spoken to him on the phone. Oh yes, I'll get back with you. I'm terribly busy. I will. I'll make an appointment with you.
1 week later, he finally tracks him down. He's still in Gainesville, moonlighting at a nearby hospital.
I went out to the hospital, North Nature Coast Hospital in Williston, Florida, to see whether he would have access to propofol, or what was their control of propofol and etomidate. While I was out there, his car was in the parking lot, and so I went down to the emergency room where he was.
I'm looking for Oliver O'Quinn. Oliver O'Quinn.
Excuse me 1 second.
I'm Detective Michael Douglas. Mr. O'Quinn, we've been calling you several times and you're not returning our calls. Is there a reason?
It's been really busy, I apologize. I'm planning to go on vacation.
And he just stood there and looked at me. And I said, aren't you even curious why I'm calling you? And he says, yeah, why? I said, I'm investigating the death of Michelle Herndon. And he looked at me and he says, oh yeah, I read about that in the paper.
I saw something on the news.
And I said, well, look, here's my card. Call me and do it before vacation, all right? So we'll just get this out of the way.
Whenever you're ready, you call me.
And of course, I heard nothing from him.
You too.
Yes, sir.
8 days later, the FBI informs Detective Douglas that Oliver has flown to Ireland.
So in the meantime, I drive up to Eastern Tennessee to talk to Oliver's dad, Beecher Oakley. I said, okay. I said, when's the last time you talked to him? He says, just around Thanksgiving. He came by, and I said, well, Well, he must have been pretty happy, cheerful, glad to see you. He's, you know, about to go on vacation. Was he in a good frame of mind? And he said, well, no, actually, he's kind of sad. I said, sad? Why would he be sad? He said that a girlfriend of his in Gainesville had died of an overdose. And that was unknown to anyone at that point.
In fact, the only way for Oliver to know about the overdose is if he witnessed it, or, as the police are beginning to think, even caused it.
Jesus. You scared me.
Feeling any better?
No. It won't go away. I've tried everything, and nothing gets rid of it.
Well, I have some stuff, you know, that can work.
Really?
Yeah.
I have to go lie down.
Okay. It acts pretty fast, actually. Only take a second. And don't be as good as...
Based upon what I learned, is that he seemed to be a dark little dude. He lived in this fantasy world that he told Jessica that he was a pararescue jumper in Afghanistan, and he'd saved lives, and he'd taken lives, and the closest thing he ever came to that, I think he was in the Navy ROTC.
What the investigation revealed was that the night of Michelle Hernan's murder, Oliver O'Quinn began very quickly from that moment forward, very discreetly distancing himself. He had started visiting family. He was telling the same story, that he was beginning to prepare to go on a 2-week vacation to Ireland.
Detective Douglas finally obtains a warrant for Oliver's arrest.
I think that out of spite, he took her life.
But the warrant comes 2 weeks too late. Ireland has a strong stand against the death penalty, and it'll be nearly impossible to extradite him to the U.S.
I think everyone's initial reaction was, it was a blow. I mean, it took the air out of you. It really took the wind out of you.
It looks like Oliver could get away with murder.
He just literally just turned and ran, just ran.
The odds were against us.
After murder suspect Oliver O'Quinn flees to Ireland, the odds of bringing him to justice are slim. But then, Irish journalist Sean O'Driscoll approaches Detective Michael Douglas with a plan.
I was working for the Irish Times, and I read about it in the Florida newspapers, and I kind of thought this is an extremely serious situation in Ireland as well. I mean, if this guy has moved to Ireland and possibly working as a nurse in Ireland, then people really ought to know about it. So I immediately called Detective Michael Douglas in Florida, in Gainesville, and asked him to give me as much information as possible about the case.
Talk to me.
So, well, you know, I've been following this for a while now. And the problem that you've come across is that he's living well. He's got no issues now.
That's right.
What we need to do is find a way to flush him out.
Absolutely.
Michael and the other detectives in Florida were deeply, deeply frustrated with the extradition process in Ireland.
He asked me if there's something he could do to help, and I said, yeah, absolutely.
So I published an article in the Irish Times.
And hopefully he would read it, and people on his street in Dublin would read it, and there would be a public outcry, and that would be enough to get him to flee Ireland.
Therefore, everywhere he goes, he'll be recognized. They'll know who he is and what he's done.
No one had tried it before, so the way I saw it, it was kind of like if we could get the chicken to fly the coop and fly somewhere else where he could be caught, then it was certainly worth giving it a try.
So please, you know, let's do this.
Sean's article is printed on April 20th, 2006, and soon the Irish press is flooded with stories about the case.
We were both holding our breath, waiting to see if Oliver was going to make a move.
If he had showed up at any embassy or presented his passport as identification, on the international level, it would have been flagged.
It was a bit of a risk to expose Oliver because of who he was, because he was emotionally very volatile. Weren't really sure how he was going to react to it, like would it lead to him striking out or taking hostages. So there was a lot at stake, and it was a nerve-wracking situation for everybody.
Within a week, Oliver flees Dublin.
Michael contacted me. He was pretty excited. They had picked up monitoring of Oliver that he had left via Dublin airport.
Then he vanishes.
He disappeared. And we were sure that he left Dublin, but we had no idea where he was.
8 weeks later, Interpol reports a sighting of him in Africa.
As luck would have it, he turns up at the United States Embassy in Mauritania, in West Africa, to claim a money order that had been sent to him.
Their computer system showed up who he was, and they asked him to hold on for a few moments. They're looking back at him, he realizes something's up, and he just literally just turned and ran.
Less than 24 hours later, Oliver resurfaces in Senegal.
Obviously, you know, some tall Irish-American guy is going to stand out in a place like Senegal, so he was very visible.
Oliver is arrested by the Senegalese army and thrown into a holding cell.
It was very lucky for everybody involved that it was a moment of panic that led him to Senegal. If he had had time to go to an internet cafe in Mauritania and kind of studied extradition treaties, he certainly would not have fled to Senegal.
So, thank goodness, they just deported him. They turned him over to the United States Marshals, said, come get him.
Two years later, Oliver O'Quinn stands trial for the first-degree murder of Michelle Herndon. He pleads not guilty. Family and friends are upset by the sight of Oliver in the courtroom.
That was weird. Because, you know, your first reaction when you see somebody you know is, hey, I know that guy. But then it's, oh yeah, I do know that guy. He's the one that killed my friend. Just kind of a weird, it's not really an emotion that's built into most people. They don't really know what to do with that.
The defense during the trial was trying to insinuate that Michelle Herndon's death was an accident, that whatever had taken place between her and Oliver O'Quinn was consensual, and that her death was the result of an accident.
The prosecution tells a different tale.
What we believe Oliver O'Quinn's motivation for killing Michelle Herndon was that he had been shunned, basically.
Like, there was nothing that was ever going to happen with him. I mean, he's not even good looking, and he's kind of nerdy.
When he arrived back in the United States and was in jail, he was boarding with another inmate. That inmate ultimately came forward and stated that Oliver O'Quinn had told him that he had overheard Michelle Herndon make a comment that Oliver O'Quinn was just a little man. And his comment to his roommate in the jail was that she deserved a long, peaceful sleep for saying that. Michelle Herndon had put him down, so now he had to put her down. The state's belief was that Oliver O'Quinn had earned Michelle Herndon's trust over the period of months that he had befriended her, and that during that trust, he had given her some drugs that actually did assist and help with the pain from her migraines. But that on the night of November 8th of 2005, when she extended her arm to him for some relief, he didn't give her the drugs that had helped her with her migraines. He injected her with four times the lethal dose of a different drug, propofol.
After only 90 minutes of deliberation, a jury finds Oliver Travis O'Quinn guilty of first-degree murder. He is sentenced to life in prison. He files an appeal immediately after the trial. It's denied.
How could somebody that I live with be capable of that? You think you know somebody, but you don't.
I think that the most insidious thing about this is Oliver O'Quinn was in Michelle Herndon's home by virtue of a trust that he had established with her, and then comes into the home under the guise that I'm going to help you, my friend, someone I care about, when you know all along that what I'm about to do is murder you. when you have children, you try to teach your children, you know, of what to look for and to protect themselves. But the reality is there are just some things in the world that you're never gonna know.
Michelle was the angel of that entire family. She was doing something noble and good. And many of the people in the family, I think, were so immensely proud of her for that.
Michelle wanted to help everybody. She wanted everybody to feel loved and everybody to feel important. So I know Michelle, with her big heart, it's almost like her big heart blinded her sometimes, that she couldn't see that, you know, some people don't always need all the help that you're wanting to give.